Greetings and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate, coming your way out of Pressevi headquarters in Tehran. I'm your host, Mehrooz Najafi. The 39th summit of the Persian Gulf Arab states, known as the GCC, was held in the Saudi capital on Sunday. The summit sought, among other things, to resolve a diplomatic crisis between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but to no avail. Qatari Emir refused to attend the summit and dispatched his foreign minister instead, which faced criticism from a number of member states. King Salman of Saudi Arabia accused Iran of interfering in the affairs of the countries in the region. The GCC is calling for unity while it is suffering from divisions and has been unable to resolve Qatar-Saudi dispute that it expelled over terrorism charges. Now, what's the real agenda of the GCC? All right, now with that report, let me introduce our guests who are joining me in this debate. We'll have a founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane from Washington, D.C. Also, director of Eurasia Future, Adam Gary, who's joining us from London. Thank you both, gentlemen. Now, let me start with Michael Lane. The GCC summit communique calls for unity, whereas no explicit mention was made of the boycott of member state Qatar. Now, a Qatari foreign ministry spokesman has condemned the communique for not discussing or resolving the blockade. How could the summit call for unity while it's avoiding addressing it?
Thank you for having me on. A very interesting question. I guess the real answer to that, honestly, is that diplomatic language can call for unity anytime they want, whether or not it exists. What we saw was a diplomatic summit, a summit that didn't really have a particularly important agenda that was facing the participants. I believe that most of the members of the GCC wanted to have a show of unity, which is why you had, unlike last year, you had five of the six heads of state there for the photo op and sitting through the day's activities. But in the end, there were no substantive important decisions made. There was no addressing of the subtext of the GCC, which is the ongoing dispute with Qatar. And there was no resolution to that particular issue. So there was a lot of nice diplomatic photo opportunities. There was a lot of nice diplomatic language, seeking unity, declaring that there was unity. But in the end, it was sort of a non-summit, a non-productive summit.
Let me now turn to Adam Gary. Adam, last year's summit was held in Kuwait, and in that summit, Qatar participated, but the quartet that boycotted it did not. What has forced the GCC to extend an invitation to Doha to take part in this year's meeting while the problem among them still persists?
Well, we have to remember that the invitation from Riyadh, effectively, to Doha was issued before Qatar made the surprise announcement to withdraw from OPEC, the first Arab state to ever do so. It was an attempt to try to at least window dress this dispute, even though because of the differences in terms of energy policy, in terms of energy ambition, in terms of geopolitical alignment, and of course those differences are increasing between Doha and its antagonists, it was never really going to be anything more than window dressing. Then when Doha sprung the surprise announcement of OPEC withdrawal on the world, and indeed on the GCC, it became all the more clear that the summit was going to be a bit like performing cosmetic surgery on someone's ashes rather than doing any actual palliative care.
All right, Michael Lane, do you agree with that?
I don't think we're pronouncing the GCC dead quite yet. It's been around for, I guess, almost 40 years. It still has a purpose. It has five of the six members that are active participants. They do need to resolve this long-standing issue with Qatar. It can't go on and have the GCC function as it's supposed to function. That will require some diplomacy. It will require some compromise on both parts. Both sides have really dug in over the last 2 years and are not making any efforts to really come to a resolution on it. But I think to declare the GCC dead and buried at this point is a little premature.
Now, Adam, GCC member state Kuwait has called for a halt to media campaigns in the region and respect-based ties among Arab states and Iran, while Saudi Arabia and the UAE think otherwise. What's your assessment?
Well, that's one example of the main dividing line within the GCC, even when one excludes Qatar. You've got what one can call the more radical members of the group, which is centered around the Saudi, UAE, Bahraini axis. And then you have Kuwait and you have Oman, which are more moderate members whose ethos can kind of sort of be summarized as, can't we all just get along? Then we've got Qatar, which is the odd man out in terms of political cooperation, but which hasn't successfully been able to have its economy overturned by the boycott initiated by Riyadh in 2017. In fact, Qatar's ability to stand on its own two feet certainly hasn't surprised a lot of people in the wider world, but it has surprised some people in Riyadh. While China and Russia have maintained neutral relations with all GCC members on a striving for a win-win basis, and while the United States, in spite of the Trump family's close relationship to the MBS branch of the House of Saud, the U.S. still maintains good relations with Qatar and has a very big military base there. And of course, Turkey, one of the most important countries in the wider Western Eurasian Middle Eastern region, has doubled, maybe even trebled, the strength of its alliance with Qatar. And there's even there's whispers that Doha and Tehran might engage in some sort of cooperative partnership, especially where gas is concerned in the future. So the attempt by Riyadh to blow little Qatar out of the water has really blown back in Riyadh's face, and the window dressing that we saw over the weekend in Riyadh is one of the conclusions that has derived from that.
Now, Michael Lane, as you know, Qatar has recently left the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. Adam Gary also mentioned. What could be the main reason for this move, and is this another sign of discord among Arab states?
Well, there's two reasons. One is the economic reality of it, and the other is diplomacy. I think this was Qatar saying yes, that they weren't going to participate in OPEC anymore. They were going to chart their own course. It was certainly coming just before the GCC summit, a message that was sent to parties in the region that I think was received fairly loudly. So it was a diplomatic move. At the same time, it is also, the reality is, it's an economic move. OPEC doesn't do a lot for Qatar. They have moved much more importantly from their economy into a gas economy, and they can really survive and do quite well on that. I'd like to echo what my colleague said in his last answer, as long as we're talking about Qatar doing well. They are doing well, and the expected quick resolution to the boycott by the GCC countries has not happened, and so it's time for them to get back together, put their diplomatic niceties together, come back with a unifying statement that everybody can live with, the same way they did at the GCC summit, and move forward from there. I just don't think that there's going to be a substantial change in the foreseeable future as a result of continuing the boycott.
Now, Adam, what do you think is the reason for Qatar moving the OPEC? You know, one of the officials, I remember, he said that maybe the oil minister or another official, he said when he was announcing this news that Qatar is leaving because it's going to focus more on its gas reserves than oil. Is that a good reason?
I'm not sure if it's a good or a bad reason, but it is an objectively true reason. Qatar produces less than 2% of all of OPEC's oil output, whereas Qatar has one of the top three gas reserves in the world, along with Russia and Iran. So in that sense, Qatar clearly wants to pivot its energy priorities from the Saudi-dominated oil trade into gas. But timing is everything, both in comedy, tragedy, and in geopolitical affairs, and because of that, it was clear that the timing was meant to throw a kind of fly into the ointment of the OPEC stroke OPEC Plus meeting in Vienna, which has, to some people's surprise, resulted in a win-win format that's even seen the de facto leaders of the OPEC Plus format give Iran, Venezuela, and the failed state of Libya exemptions on the production cut. I think that Russia's participation in this OPEC Plus format may have had something to do with that, as Russia is one of the few countries in the world to have positive relations with an MBS-dominated Saudi Arabia and with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Be that as it may, that is where we are. Qatar is moving more into the field of gas, and crucially, I think that Saudi Arabia and the UAE will be watching to see if Qatar is going to cooperate with Iran on extracting gas from a maritime oil field which both countries share. If that does indeed happen, the Saudis will have to make a decision. Are they going to become more radical in their anti-Iranian and anti-Qatari position, or are they going to wake up to the reality that any war in the region is going to be bad for the energy exports of all the nations? One could only hope that they would choose the pragmatic option, but the slaying of a journalist called Jamal Khashoggi is proof positive that pragmatism doesn't always rule the day in Riyadh.
Well, you just mentioned Jamal Khashoggi at the right time. I was going to ask Michael Lane about the murder of this Saudi journalist, Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. How has that affected the Saudi policies that's now facing international criticism for their role? You know, CIA finding says that MBS directly ordered the killing.
Yes, well, of course, the Saudi government has taken responsibility for the killing. They said it happened in their consulate, and they're upfront about that. Whether or not we have the precise details on everything that happened from all sides together, I think those are still coming out, some of them perhaps even still being collected. But the Saudi government has taken responsibility for it. I think the places where we see policy impacts on this are, number one, the Trump administration moved early on in the Khashoggi story to really work closer with Riyadh in terms of finding a diplomatic resolution to the Yemen war. That's been going on for about 3 years now. It's a terrible humanitarian crisis that is precipitating almost, you know, right on us now. And it really needs a resolution to that, as well as a political solution to the military part of the crisis. So for the Trump administration to have pivoted on that particular issue about 4 or 6 weeks ago and to really work much closer with Riyadh in terms of finding a negotiated solution and a humanitarian solution, I think is probably the most significant policy change that has come out of that particular story.
Adam Gary, Michael Lane is saying that the Saudis accepted responsibility for Khashoggi's murder. Do you agree with that? And also, a number of GCC member states in this summit Sunday, they praised Riyadh for regarding the Khashoggi case and what they have done, whereas they come up with different stories. And finally, it was proven by CIA and the Turkish probe that MBS ordered it. But and also Turkey is asking for an extradition of the culprits because the thing has happened inside Turkish soil. Now let's have your take.
Well, the CIA probe remains secret, so I can't comment on that, and I'm not aware that Turkey's actually directly pointed the finger at MBS. There's been a lot of allusions to that, so I think it's best I don't comment on that either. What I will say, though, is that it was a bit of a farce in October and November watching Riyadh change its story about Khashoggi every 24 hours, it seems. And it's really because and only because of Turkish pressure, the drip-feed method of letting the public know what the authorities have discovered, that Riyadh did admit that its workers, its operatives in the consulate in Istanbul were responsible for the murder. But Turkey, which is frankly the only country in the world that seems genuinely concerned about this issue, still is clearly unsatisfied with the level of cooperation between Riyadh and Ankara. There were talks that MBS was going to meet President Erdogan at the recent G20 summit. That didn't happen. That only prolonged this atmosphere of tension that was always, frankly, tense in the last few years between Ankara and Riyadh. So I'm not sure that a light at the end of that particularly gruesome tunnel is any more forthcoming today than it was 2 weeks ago.
Right. Michael Lane, some observers and analysts believe that Washington is also pressuring Riyadh into ending the blockade on Qatar and also sort of finish the war on Yemen and bring Arab states together in order to unite against Iran. What do you think?
Well, okay, so the State Department issued a statement at the G or in advance of the GCC urging unity, urging the parties to resolve their differences on terms that were acceptable to the parties concerned, not terms acceptable to the United States. I think that's the diplomatic nicety out front. I think on the inside, there's a lot of pressure being put on to resolve this, to bring the GCC back together as a full participating six members, and to use the GCC in a way that it was originally intended when it was founded, as a counterbalance against increasing hegemony of the government of Iran throughout the entire region. It makes it more difficult for the GCC to operate in that fashion if they're divided and split the way they are, with Qatar being on the outside due to the boycott. So the United States is putting pressure on the GCC governments to make that happen, but you wouldn't know that from the diplomatic niceties. You'd have to be inside the rooms and hear exactly what's going on, but it's there.
Okay, using the word hegemony regarding Iran, I'm not sure if it's the right word, because, you know, maybe influence. Anyway, let me ask Adam Gary. GCC member states at the end of their summit, they set the target of ensuring financial unity and a unified military command by the year 2025. Do you find this possible, you know, given the division existing on various issues among member states within GCC?
Well, the short answer is no, and the long answer is that we need to examine the efficacy of the GCC as a microcosm of the Arab League. Now, the Arab League could be one of the most important pan-national organizations on the planet, but instead it's an organization that has really become a byword for deadlock. Every year the Arab League meets, sometime, well, more than once a year, and every time they have their meeting, they talk about the importance of securing justice for Palestine. And what happens? More Palestinians killed, more of these colonial settlements built, more barbed wire fences going up, more snipers laughing at the death of civilians. And so what good is the Arab League? It could have been a lot of good. It was conceived with the best of intentions, but it's fairly useless now. The GCC isn't quite at that level of Jurassic uselessness yet, but the GCC does risk becoming little more than a talking shop. OPEC is important. OPEC Plus is very important. And the GCC members, with the exception of Qatar, are in there. But the organization itself seems to have lost its way a bit, because what's an organization without unity? The answer, as we saw 24 hours ago, is not much.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Lane, let's have your final thoughts. Do you see this feasible, that GCC will have unified military command and financial unity by the year 2025? 30 seconds, please.
Well, certainly it's possible, but step one is resolving the issue that they have facing them. If they, you know, if 6-7 years from now we're still facing a diversion and a split, then there's no way that's going to happen. I mean, why would you allow your military commanders to be placed under a unified command under those circumstances if you're not getting along in any other area with the countries that you're involved in? If they can move expeditiously to create that unity, then yes, they can accomplish their other goal, which is a unified command by 2025. But mm-hmm. You got to get to step one before you can get to step five.
Yes, and maybe that's a big if. We'll gotta wait. Have to wait and see what's going to happen. All right, let me thank our guests who joined us. We had a founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane, who joined us from Washington, D.C., and director of Eurasia Future, Adam Gary, who joined us from London. Thank you both, gentlemen. And thank you for watching this debate today. We'll see you next time.